All right, so our speaker today is Chloe Rafferty, who is the founding member of the Wollongong branch, saviour of the bus, if you know what I mean. But she's going to be talking for about 40 minutes on the topic today, and then we'll have time for discussion. So please make Chloe feel welcome.
Okay, so in 1844, an uprising of weavers breaks out in Silesia, Germany. The workers smash machines and demolish several of their bosses' mansions. And while most of the liberal radicals of Germany downplayed or ignored the significance of the strike, Karl Marx was its keenest chronicler. And this limited regional uprising of around 5,000 weavers, while it was easily suppressed by Prussian soldiers, it inspired Marx to write, "Where then is the positive possibility of a German emancipation? Answer, in the formation of a class with radical chains. This dissolution of society as a particular state is the proletariat." Karl Marx had started out his revolutionary career as a radical liberal. He was concerned with winning liberal democracy, the vote, the abolition of feudal privileges, freedom of the press and of association. And he had been searching for a section of society with the interest and the social power to win these rights. And this is what led him to the proletariat. By 1844, he argued that it wasn't enough to simply critique the particular monarchical despotism of the Prussian state. The state, he said, could not be a universal institution sitting above society. This was an illusion. Marx argued that the state was always a class institution. Even the highest achievements of the radicals and republicans could only create an order built on the particular interests of a class. The Silesian Weavers' Revolt had helped Marx to recognise that the proletariat in action, a class without property, could represent a universal interest. They fought not just for a political revolution, but for a social one, for the abolition of class society. As Marx put it at the time, "However partial the uprising of the industrial workers may be, it contains within itself a universal soul. However universal a political uprising may be, it conceals, even in its most grandiose forms, a narrow-minded spirit." 1844 was also the year that Marx and Engels began their lifelong collaboration. The two revolutionaries would be the nucleus for the Marx Party, a shared political project which would take many forms over their lifetime. Intellectual milieu, political party, broad anti-capitalist international, and at all times the revolutionary wing of the workers' movement. Engels had come to many of the same conclusions as Marx, but had a closer familiarity with the conditions and the cultural political level of the most advanced section of the working class, the English proletariat. And Marx and Engels did not think that working class consciousness was automatic. In opposition to utopians and conspirators who thought that the masses would be roused to the heroic deeds of an enlightened minority, Marx and Engels argued that the emancipation of the working class must be conquered by the working class themselves. To do this, they argued that the educator must be educated, that the working class needed to become conscious of its class position and its tasks through struggle. Marx understood that class consciousness could be measured by class organisation. This class organisation, at its most basic level, would take the form of associations or unions. But they recognised that revolutionary workers needed to form political organisations to propagate their ideas and coordinate revolutionary activity both nationally and internationally. From very early on in their collaboration, Marx and Engels started to build revolutionary organisations. Communist ideas needed more than occasional speeches or literary networks to win a mass audience. They needed a party. Early on in their partnership, Marx and Engels threw themselves into practical activity and theoretical writing in order to intervene into the existing socialist movements. And after working through their split with the young Hegelians and the German ideology, Marx and Engels made a more serious turn at intervention into the workers' movement. So the German ideology, which wasn't published until many, many years after Marx's death, was mainly an exercise in self-clarification. Its central contribution to Marx and Engels was actually ridding themselves in any illusions that they might still have held about the contribution of German philosophy. Instead, after the German ideology, they argued that only through revolutionary practice could communism be realised. And in particular, in this period, Marx attacks the vague, humanistic and idealist understandings of socialism which dominated the movement at the time. He argued that class struggle, not human understanding or the brotherhood of man, was the basis for the fight for communism. He wanted to win mass influence for these ideas, intervening into literary debates, mass workers' meetings and existing organisations. Before his exile from Paris in 1845, there's a nice little description of his activity written down for us by French police spies, who reported on his activities, claimed that Marx gave speeches to sometimes 30, often 100 to 200 Germans, and that he was the leader of a group of intriguers who take advantage of the poor German artisans and also young business people and clerks to seduce them into communism. So the Communist League was the first Marxist workers' party. And in establishing a party, Marx and Engels were compelled by the growing organisation and political sophistication of the workers' movement, and also by a sense of urgency from the increasing signs of an imminent revolution, which would break out in 1848, a year after they officially joined what was then called the League of the Just. So the League of the Just, which was renamed the Communist League in 1848, was the most politically sophisticated organisation of German workers at the time. Despite this, it contained a variety of confused, competing currents of socialist thought. So when Marx and Engels entered the League of the Just, they attempted to win a proletarian following away from the dominant socialist ideas of the time. And these were a mixture of utopian humanist ideas, which often advocated for prefigurative communes to be established, or voluntarist kind of conspiracies, which advocated for the planning of minority insurrections, or small producer cooperatives supported by artisans. They were kind of a lot of the dominant currents. So theorists like Proudhon and the German artisan leader Wittling had a following in the League. And while Wittling was for revolution, he oriented to small property-owning artisans and the lumpen proletariat, and had a voluntarist approach to revolution with no desire to understand the material conditions which produced revolution. Proudhon had by this time rejected revolution and advocated instead for artisanal associations and later for mutual credit associations as economic reforms, which he argued could gradually socialise production. In opposition, Marx and Engels would fight for a revolutionary conception of communism based on the industrial proletariat. They would win a following by polemicising against other theorists in book-length publications, public workers' meetings, more accessible pamphlets, and within party meetings. The first major argument that Marx and Engels won inside the League was against conspiratorial organising. So proletarian conspiracies or secret associations had their origin in Babeuf's Conspiracy of Equals of 1796. The fight for socialism was by them seen as the work of a tiny elite band of insurrectionists organised secretly. They thought only small elites of emancipated progressives could be involved in preparing for a revolution on behalf of the vast mass of inert and ignorant common people. One of the League's founders, Art Schaper, had been involved in Blanqui's unsuccessful push in 1839. But by 1846, the London League was much more open to Marx's argument against conspiratorial organisation, partly because of the long history of failed secret societies and because of the positive influence of the Chartist movement, which was a mass open, democratic, proletarian movement. So under Marx and Engels' influence, the League broke decisively with conspiratorial forms and was much more open and democratic, with annual elections and with rules which demanded less obedience and more rights to the mass of members. The League now conceived of itself as a practical and propaganda organisation of communist workers rather than a band of elites secretly directing inert masses. So the League set up and operated also within the larger workers' education associations, which were helped to provide a legal front for activities as well as an open audience to propagate communist ideas. Marx and Engels were asked to join the League and produce its manifesto in 1847. They immediately set about trying to build its industrial worker membership to transform the League away from its previously more artisanal base into a workers' communist party. And they began with convincing branches of their literary network, the Communist Correspondence Committees, to affiliate. So this was the most advanced organisation of working class internationalists and revolutionaries approaching Marx and Engels to provide leadership on the eve of a revolution. They're in no way duped or cajoled into offering this leadership, but him had been convinced by several years of comradely but unflinching polemics against the existing socialist theories and forms of practical organisation. The Communist League would enter the 1848 revolutions as the most politically sophisticated, organisationally open and democratic workers' party, with the Communist Manifesto as its self-declared guide to political action. Just to look a little bit at the kind of theoretical basis for a lot of their ideas. For Marx, the bourgeois revolutions of the past provided the beginnings of a tradition that socialists could build on. The French Revolution of 1789 had demonstrated the transformative role of a popular revolution, the role of revolutionary violence, the relations of class forces and their alliances, the way crises in the economic base of society could lead to a revolutionary outbreak. And in the early bourgeois revolutions, the interests of the bourgeoisie and the interests of the masses had been inseparable. The bourgeoisie was able to present its particular interests as the general interests of society, and this is what made it, at the time, a revolutionary class. When the people fought for liberty, equality, fraternity, they were united around a program which presented bourgeois aims in a universal language. For the non-bourgeois masses, this wasn't just ideology, it was also true. It was in the interest of the masses to fight to overthrow the institutions of feudal rule. Even as early as the French Revolution, the big bourgeoisie as individuals were cowardly, hesitant, and prone to make peace with the feudal order. The non-bourgeois masses of artisans, proto-workers, and petty bourgeoisie were often the most decisive and radical elements of the revolution, pushing it along against the passivity of the more moderate and hesitant big bourgeoisie. But while the masses were more decisive in the French Revolution, such as the sans-culottes, they never parted ways with pursuing a bourgeois objective in 1789. So they fought for the attainment of bourgeois aims. As the English Marxist Alex Kolinnikov says, French terrorism was nothing but a plebeian way of dealing with the enemies of the bourgeoisie. But by the 1840s, the position of the bourgeoisie in relation to the rest of the masses had shifted decisively. The bourgeoisie was no longer able to present its particular interests as the universal interest of society. The non-bourgeois masses were no longer simply the most decisive element in the struggle for bourgeois goals. They would begin to struggle for their own class interests independent of and in opposition to the bourgeoisie. The bourgeoisie recognised that the masses weren't just challenging their enemies, but also their own order. This is why Marx noted the weakness in his time of the liberal bourgeoisie in its pursuit of reforms. Instead of an alliance with the liberal bourgeoisie, Marx would advocate for the working class to lead an alliance of the peasantry and petty bourgeoisie. Marx recognised that the class antagonism between the modern classes of bourgeoisie and proletariat would be at the centre of the coming revolution. So the revolutions of 1848 represent the first examples of independent working class political action in European history. It marked the moment at which the modern socialist movement began to take shape. An economic crisis in 1847, which along with the potato blight led to a crippling famine across Europe, immediately precipitated the revolutionary crisis. A panic in the British financial markets led to a sharp recession and the closing of many factories and mills. And this economic turmoil spread to continental Europe and provoked a wave of bankruptcies and mass unemployment in cities, major cities like Paris. So the argument Marx and Engels had made about a crisis between the forces of production and the relations of production opening up the conditions for a revolution was unfolding across Europe. The despotism of many European governments magnified anger at the economic misery sweeping Europe. Revolts would break out through the weakest fault lines of the political order, where the previous waves of bourgeois revolution had failed or had been rolled back. The oppressed nationalities ruled by the Austrian Empire, the ununified Germany, divided by squabbling despotic principalities, the restored monarchy of France, and the papal backwardsness of Rome. Revolution would burst through these fault lines and expose not only the backwards feudal structures of European states, but also the competing interests of the modern classes. Marx had argued the bourgeoisie was no longer a revolutionary class and instead was reactionary, willing to compromise with despotism and the old aristocratic classes for fear of awakening the aspirations of the masses. His prediction would be borne out in the events of 1848. So in Paris, to get around the ban on demonstrations, social democrats had been organising workers' banquets to agitate against the monarchy and around support for a social republic. When King Louis-Philippe banned the banquets in February, this led to demonstrations and barricades and the collapse of the restored monarchy. The Second Republic was proclaimed along with universal male suffrage. The establishment of the Second Republic led to enormous class polarisation in Paris. The central question was the attitude to the national workshops. The defence of the workshops, along with the general demand for a social republic, showed the working class of Paris expressing its own interests in independent political action. The bourgeoisie of France was intractably hostile to the national workshops, hostile to any further social reform, and most importantly, the increasing political independence and activity of the proletariat. They were interested in stability, were hostile to increased taxes, and above all, wanted the restoration of order. In June, the provisional government closed the national workshops, provoking a confrontation with the workers. The Parisian proletariat responded with the June uprising, the establishment of barricades, protests, and rioting across Paris. The National Guard intervened to crush the June uprising, and 10,000 people were either killed or injured, while 4,000 insurgents were deported to Algeria. Compared to 1789, the class struggle was now at a much more advanced stage. The working class entered into the struggle under its own banner, around its own class demands, rather than as the supportive battering ram of bourgeois aims. As Marx had predicted in the manifesto, the working class confronted the bourgeoisie not as in an alliance, but as enemies. The bourgeoisie quickly looked to the centralized state to repress the workers and restore stability, even if this came at the expense of their own political rights. Over the months of the revolution, the bourgeoisie's political representatives repressed workers, repressed political rights, and undermined the basis for republican democracy, eventually looking to Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte to restore order by liquidating the republic in a coup. As Marx pointed out in the 18th Brumaire of Louis-Napoleon, when the bourgeoisie's own republican order is threatened by working-class insurrection, they preferred a centralised dictatorship which could ensure stable stock markets to a democratic republic. In Germany, several weeks before the uprising which launched the German Revolution, Communist League activists in Cologne organised a demonstration of 5,000 workers. 5,000 workers and artisans to demand basic democratic rights. When the revolution broke out, Marx and Engels immediately took the opportunity to return to Germany and begin openly organising the Communist League amidst the revolution. They returned to Germany along with 300 to 400 supporters of the League. Marx based himself in Cologne, one of the most industrially and politically advanced cities of Germany. He resurrected the Neue Rheinische Zeitung, his old newspaper, a daily press which would be the most influential voice of the left in Germany. The Communist League put into practice the class alliance they had argued for in the manifesto, setting up where possible independent workers' organisations while intervening into petty bourgeois democratic associations and assisting in setting up radical peasant organisations. At one point, Marx personally represented this class alliance. He was simultaneously the chair of three organisations, a radical workers, peasants and petty bourgeois democratic association. As Engels commented on the bourgeois radicals of Cologne, which Cologne was like the centre of liberal bourgeois thought, even these radical bourgeoisie here see us as their future main enemies and have no intention of putting into our hands weapons which we should very shortly turn against them. So the growth of an independent workers' movement was enormous, though politically very mixed. 5,000 people, workers, affiliated to the new Cologne Workers' Association, which grew to 8,000 members by the end of June. But Marx would need to argue against currents in the League which would push it in a more moderate direction. Some League members had a sectarian attitude to the petty bourgeois Democrats, a workerism, which gave cover to a moderate approach to the question of democratic reform. So the workerists in the Communist League called for a constitutional monarchy on the grounds that Marx's demand for a republic would frighten the bourgeoisie. The German bourgeoisie refused to take bold action against the feudal institutions and in favour of German unification, instead accommodating to the crown in a weak constitutional monarchy. As the bourgeois parliamentarians prevaricated and capitulated in the Frankfurt National Assembly, the Prussian king built up his strength, imposed a monarchist constitution, dissolved the assembly, and put down the uncoordinated revolts. During the German reaction, Marx and his League comrades organised a committee of public safety and attempted to agitate for the arming of the working class. Engels helped to coordinate the barricades at Elberfeld, one of the last holdouts of the revolution, which was defended with a proletarian army of 30,000 revolutionaries led by former League member Willich. But despite these heroic efforts, the capitulation of the bourgeois liberals had opened the door for a counter-revolution which swept all of Germany. Marx commented on the revolution that history presents no example of greater wretchedness than that of the German bourgeoisie. Marx argued by the end of 1850 that the period of revolution was over. The European economy had stabilised and order was restored across Europe through counter-revolution in Germany, Italy, Hungary and Poland, and the establishment of Napoleon III's empire in France. He argued that the European working class was entering a period of reaction, and that the period lying ahead was one of preparatory propaganda and educational work. Many Communist League leaders who had previously sided with Marx and Engels, like Schäper, could not accept this. They sided with voluntarists like Wheatling, who claimed that immediate revolution was still the order of the day. Sadly, the League would split and then rapidly dissolve after the debates and repression of the counter-revolution. As Marx said during the split, it's a bit of a long quote, but it's a good one. In place of the critical outlook, the minority substitutes a dogmatic one. In place of the materialist, an idealist one. Instead of the actual conditions, pure will becomes the drive wheel of the revolution for them. Whereas we tell the workers, you have 15, 20, 50 years of civil war and people struggles to go through, not only to change the conditions, but in order to change yourselves and make yourselves fit for political rule, you say, on the contrary, we must come to power right away, or else we may as well go to sleep. In opposition to what a lot of academia says about Marx, that he was a determinist, teleological, and overly optimistic about the prospects of winning communism, in 1848, Marx was very cool and level-headed and criticised by some of his comrades for being too conservative. Marx emphasised the importance of organisation, but this organisation would be building on sand if it could not get to grips with the concrete conditions and have a realistic assessment of the opportunities on offer for the workers' movement. Much like Lenin had to argue after the defeat of the 1905 revolution against the ultra-lefts, Marx was against the voluntarism of other League leaders who could not accept that the space for mass activity had been closed off by counter-revolution, and a retreat to patient propaganda work was necessary. The Communist League, nevertheless, it was an important organisation in establishing a precedent for revolutionary organising. Its final contribution to revolutionary theory was Marx and Engels' March Address of 1850, which I highly recommend people reading if you haven't. This drew up a balance sheet of the lessons of 1848, the revolutions, and ended with a call for permanent revolution. As Marx had predicted before the revolutionary crisis, the bourgeoisie had betrayed the revolution. Rather than bringing together the popular classes around its goals, the bourgeoisie had found itself confronted by the independent class goals of the popular masses. In the March Address, Marx points out how the bourgeoisie used its newly won state power to crush the working class, but to do this, it needed to enter into alliance with the old feudal forces. The bourgeoisie's newly won state power would eventually be surrendered to the feudal powers as the logical continuation of the reaction the bourgeoisie had unleashed on the proletariat. As Marx says, the bourgeoisie could accomplish this only by entering into alliance with the feudal party, which had been defeated in March, and eventually had to surrender power once more to this feudal absolutist party. It has, nevertheless, secured favourable conditions for itself. You can see later with the unification that happens of Germany under Bismarck is an example of this. So the petty bourgeoisie, Marx said, would during the revolution claim to be social democrats, reds and republicans, but when in government, they would work to bring the revolution to an end quickly, attempting to appease the bourgeoisie and balance the different class interests. The lesson Marx argued, which workers should draw from 1848, was that an alliance with the petty bourgeoisie could only be entered into on the basis of working class independence. As Marx said, at the moment, while the democratic petty bourgeois are everywhere oppressed, they preach to the proletariat general unity and reconciliation. They extend the hand of friendship and seek to found a great opposition party which will embrace all shades of democratic opinion. That is, they seek to ensnare the workers in a party organisation in which general social democratic phrases prevail while their particular interests are kept hidden behind, and in which, for the sake of preserving peace, the specific demands of the proletariat may not be represented. I think we'll all be a bit familiar with this in social democratic organisations of the future. So the petty bourgeois democrats, as small property-holding class, do not want to transform the economic base of society, but merely pacify the class antagonism through negotiated reform. In the 1848 revolution, subordinating working-class independence to the petty bourgeois social democrats proved disastrous. The proletarian demands raised in the early months of the French Second Republic were muted and held back by the prevarication of the petty bourgeois faction in the provisional government. This ultimately led to the reaction when the petty bourgeois social democrats were implicated in the repression of the June workers' uprising. Instead of subordination, Marx argued the working class needed to secure its independence in order to enter into alliance with the urban petty bourgeois and the peasantry. Political independence would allow the working class to push the revolutionary movement to the left and not to tail the interests of small property holders. Marx is clear that the Communist Party would need to adapt its practice to concrete conditions, but he also argued that in every situation, the communists should be accelerating the class antagonisms by mobilising for the most radical demands. He argued that the communists must drive the proposals of the Democrats to their logical extreme. The Democrats will in any case act in a reformist and not a revolutionary manner. The communists must transform these proposals into direct attacks on private property. In the revolutions which Marx was writing about, the working class was faced with the dual challenge of overthrowing absolutism and capitalism. Marx argued that rather than subordinating the struggle for socialism to the immediate task of overcoming feudal absolutism, the working class should make the revolution permanent, should continue forward without interruption, pursuing their ultimate goal. He argued, our concern cannot simply be to modify private property, but to abolish it, not to hush up class antagonisms, but to abolish classes, not to improve the existing society, but to found a new one. Marx's call for permanent revolution would prefigure Trotsky's later argument in Russia. And while the March address was a more tactical argument and was not the worked-out strategic argument of Trotsky, which was grounded in the theory of uneven and combined development, nevertheless it has many similarities. The March address was clearly a call for social revolution, going far beyond the demands of a democratic revolution. Marx argued in 1850 with the working that the working class could lead an alliance with the peasantry and petty bourgeoisie and telescope the process of a democratic and social revolution. The address is a clear argument that it was possible to continue the political revolution forward to a social revolution without interruption. In Marx's own words, it is our interest and our task to make the revolution permanent until all the more or less property classes have been driven from their ruling positions, until the proletariat has conquered state power, and until the association of the proletarians has progressed sufficiently far that competition between the proletarians of these countries ceases, and at least the decisive forces of production are concentrated in the hands of the workers. Marx's assessment of 1848 led him to a clearer understanding of the process of establishing workers' power and what that might look like. In the March address, he says that after the initial success of the revolution in overthrowing the existing government, a new government will be established in which petty bourgeois forces prevail. He argued that instead of being reduced to the position of critical supporters, the proletariat must establish its own institutions of control to discipline the government, to push it to the left, and to eventually replace it through social revolution. He says, alongside the new official governments, they, the workers, must simultaneously establish their own revolutionary workers' government, either in the form of local executive committees and councils or through workers' clubs or committees, so that the bourgeois democratic governments not only immediately lost the support of the workers, but find themselves from the very beginning supervised and threatened by authorities behind which stand the whole mass of the workers. This is pretty remarkable. What Marx is describing is a situation of dual power, and it's a remarkable insight as it would be another two decades before this situation would actually emerge in reality. And he describes this revolutionary workers' government as increasingly taking on all of the legitimate functions of the state in a proletarian form. He says, the whole proletariat must be armed at once. The workers must try to organise themselves independently as a proletarian guard, with elected leaders and with their own elected general staff. They must try to place themselves not under the orders of the state authority, but of the revolutionary local councils set up by workers. Marx's approach to workers' revolution was deepened by the experience of revolution and counter-revolution in 1848, leading him to develop his understanding of workers' power and the need to establish not only an independent revolutionary party, but also independent institutions of workers' rule. This development would continue under the impact of the Paris Commune. So after the counter-revolution in the 1850s, Marx would take a turn towards theoretical clarification, writing theories of surplus value and capital. The limitations of the Communist League highlighted the need for a more scientific study of political economy and crisis. Marx would return to building mass political organisation in 1864 with the establishment of the First International. This multi-tendency international revolutionary organisation grew out of the needs of the rising working class militancy, kicked off by an uprising in Poland, thrown into solidarity work with the North in the American Civil War, and finally reaching its height of influence during the Paris Commune of 1871. So, of all the revolutionary events of Marx's lifetime, the short-lived Paris Commune would have the deepest impact on his theory of workers' revolution. When the workers of Paris rose up against the betrayals of the Third Republic in 1871, Marx recognised in their new forms of organising the nucleus of a workers' state. The Paris Commune demonstrated, in practice, a situation which Marx had predicted in the March Address of 1850, dual power. Marx presented the Commune as a workers' government, the political form of a transition to a new social order. The Commune was an incipient workers' state, and while it only lasted 72 days, it demonstrated for the first time in history the beginnings of the political rule of the working class. As Hal Draper says, what determined the class character of the Commune for Marx was the hegemony of the proletariat in the revolution, that is, the fact that other class elements in the revolution looked to it as a vanguard and leader. While the bourgeois leaders of the Third Republic were negotiating a betrayal of Paris with the Prussian army, the communards, for a few brief weeks in Paris, had smashed and driven out the Republican state apparatus and were reorganising Paris in the interests of the working class, artisans and petty bourgeois of Paris. The Commune suppressed the standing army, replacing it with the arming of the working class. Rather than the bourgeois separation of powers, setting up layers of bureaucratic institutions, the Commune's democratic rule was executive and legislative at the same time, with representatives drawn from the working class and paid at the same rate as workers. The Commune was fiercely internationalist, tearing down symbols of war, nationalism and imperialism, and electing a German worker as Minister of Labour, even as Bismarck's German troops were stationed threateningly on the outskirts of Paris. Its social reforms moved towards winning class demands and drawing sections of industry into collective control. Its representatives abolished night work for bakers, collectivised church land, took abandoned workshops over on behalf of the Commune, set up people's courts through an elected judiciary, and abolished all fines levied by employers. Ultimately, the French bourgeoisie would convince the Prussian army, which they had been at war with just the year before, to aid them in crushing the Paris Commune. As Marx put it, after the most tremendous war of modern times, the conquering and the conquered hosts should fraternise for the common massacre of the proletariat. And if you were in the session on the Russian Revolution, that fraternising of people who used to just previously be at war with each other to crush workers' uprisings would be familiar. The bloody suppression of the Paris working class would see 20,000 revolutionaries killed in the fighting and over 43,000 prisoners captured. Marx and Engels forcefully defended the Commune from all of the so-called radical democrats who denounced the communards as criminals and vandals. Marx and Engels not only defended the actions of the Paris working class against attacks from liberals, but also amongst the supporters of the Commune, Marx argued that it needed to be understood as the first of a fundamentally new form of rule, a working class government based on democracy from below. As Marx famously argued in his account of the Commune in the Civil War in France, the working class cannot simply lay hold of the ready-made state machinery and wield it for its own purposes. The Paris Commune had not taken up the existing bourgeois state apparatus, but were building the first example of a workers' state, based on universal male suffrage, the election of all representatives and recallability. As Engels put it, from the outset, the Commune was compelled to recognise that the working class, once come to power, could not manage with the old state machine, that in order not to lose again its only just conquered supremacy, this working class must, on the one hand, do away with all of the old repressive machine previously used against itself, and on the other, safeguard itself against its own deputies and officials by declaring them all, without exception, subject to recall at any moment. As Lenin would point out in State and Revolution, uncovering Marx's revolutionary insight from decades of reformist falsification, the only significant change Marx ever made to the Communist Manifesto, he made on the basis of a revolutionary experience of the Paris Commune. He adding to the preface that the argument that the working class cannot conquer or wield the existing bourgeois state. This radical discovery, the need to smash the bureaucratic military machine, as Marx put in a letter during the Commune, would be buried by the reformist leaders of the Second International. But even in Marx and Engels' lifetime, they would critique the conservatism of many of their own followers who attempted to dispute or ignore the lessons of the Paris Commune. As late as 1891, after Marx's death, Engels remarked that, "Of late, the German social democratic Philistine has once more been filled with wholesome terror at the words, the dictatorship of the proletariat. Well and good, gentlemen, do you want to know what this dictatorship looks like? Look at the Paris Commune. That was the dictatorship of the proletariat." Marx wanted to build a political current based on the lessons drawn from the Paris Commune. In the wake of the counter-revolution which crushed the Commune, the First International was torn apart through the debates with anarchists. Marx stood for a revolutionary outlook that rejected the anti-politics and conspiratorial approach of the anarchists, as well as the conservative reformism of the British trade union leaders. I want to end with some of the lessons we can draw about Marx's understanding of revolutionary organising. So the legacy of social democracy, particularly the German Social Democratic Party, has done a lot to distort accounts of what Marx had to say about both revolution and the revolutionary party. The Social Democratic Party of Germany in the early 20th century presented itself as the embodiment of Marxist ideas. Its leaders like Kautsky were, until the First World War, considered the leading proponents of Marxism. But even after official social democracy has abandoned any desire to associate itself with Marxism, official academic Marxism often wants to claim Marx as a reformist. But Marx and Engels, from the very beginning of their partnership, attempted to put their theory of workers' revolution into organised form, intervening into the existing socialist and workers' movements. This organisation took different form depending on the level of clarity in the movement, the political climate, the tasks of the movement, and the opportunities. This organisation through Marx's life took the form of a literary current, a network of revolutionary activists, a party, a broad revolutionary workers' international. So Marx never produced a comprehensive outline for what a revolutionary workers' party should look like, but what we're left with are his writings and debates throughout his 40 years of revolutionary activism. In particular, the Communist Manifesto, the March Address, his writings for the First International, and importantly, his critique of the Gotha Programme. So the key points Marx emphasised when writing about revolutionary parties were the self-activity of the working class first and foremost, the political independence of the working class from all other classes, the class nature of the state, and the importance of concretely assessing the political situation. In the First International, Marx argued that the working class must constitute itself as a party distinct from and opposed to all old parties formed by the propertied classes, as the only means to ensure the triumph of the social revolution and its ultimate end, the abolition of classes. Marx criticised economism and argued that the industrial activity of the working class alone was not enough to challenge capitalism. And while he was the first socialist writer to support trade unions as a matter of principle, he heavily criticised trade unions as a strategy alone for limiting themselves to economic questions. He argued that it was necessary for workers to organise themselves into a political party. While Marx and Engels may have been somewhat optimistic about the rapid development of revolutionary organisation, they recognised in the manifesto that competition between workers, particularly along national lines, was continually used to undermine the process of workers forming an independent revolutionary party. The debates between Marx and Proudhon's followers in the 1840s, along with the debates with the followers of LaSalle, foreshadow the schism which would open up between the revolutionary and reformist socialists before World War I. While Marx could not be expected to predict the ultimate betrayal of the German Social Democratic Party 40 years later, he was clearly aware of the potential for significant moderation and opportunism within the socialist movement. The critique of the Gotha Programme shows Marx's decisive opposition to reformism. It was the unity program between LaSalle's followers and a German Marxist current, which would be the founding document of the German SPD. LaSalle, for people who don't know much about him, was an infamous liberal lawyer who had become a celebrity of the German workers' movement. He looked to the existing state to usher in change, the existing state being Bismarck, by bankrolling workers' cooperatives. And this included secret negotiations with Bismarck, the German Chancellor, and calls for a social and revolutionary people's monarchy. Marx's critique of the Gotha Programme is a first-rate demolition of reformist illusions in the state. Marx was scathing of the concessions which his collaborators August Bebel and Wilhelm Liebknecht made to LaSalle's supporters, and he and Engels refused to identify with their programme. Marx argued that the programme was a significant retreat from previous programmes of workers' organisations, In particular, he compared the program very unfavorably to the resolutions of the First International, an organization which had been of a much broader character, which included anarchists and trade union officials alongside social democrats. So the critique attacks reformist influence in economic theory, theoretical clarity, internationalism, the attitude to trade unions, and orientation to the state. Rather than focusing on the need to socialize production, the program instead focuses on distribution. Its main proposals were in line with LaSalle's vision of socialism, was to call on the state to fund worker cooperatives. Marx also focused on the program's vague position on the form of the German state. He jokes bitterly that a thousandfold combination of the word people and the word state can't ignore the need for a revolutionary transformation of capitalist society. No way of wording it differently makes it not a capitalist state. So not only did the program abandon the lessons of the Paris Commune, that the working class cannot lay hold of the ready-made state machine, but in the context of a despotic monarchy, the vague call for a free state was a retreat from even calling openly for a democratic republic, let alone the social republic which had been proclaimed in Paris as early as 1848. As Marx says, the German Workers' Party, at least if it adopts the program, shows that its socialist ideas are not even skin deep, in that instead of treating existing society as the basis of the existing state, it treats the state rather as an independent entity that possesses its own intellectual, ethical and libertarian basis. And Marx and Engels' letters in this period also show their opposition to moderate currents in the early party who wanted to water down demands to appeal to petty bourgeois Democrats. Marx, for instance, approved of his friend Karl Hirsch's decision to refuse the editorial post of the party newspaper, knowing who would be censored by moderate reformists who held the purse strings. In a letter to Babel in 1879, Engels resolutely declared on behalf of Marx and himself that they would have nothing to do with a party organ placed under the control of the reformist Karl Hochberg. And Marx denounced the subsequent editors, including the future-to-be revisionist Bernstein, as counter-revolutionary windbags. particularly for distancing the party from its support for the distancing it from the Paris Commune and blaming the militancy of the workers' movement for the wrath of Bismarck and the anti-socialist laws that he was putting through. So what the critique and these letters show is that even in later life, Marx had not departed from his 1847 position about the need to build a communist party. Marx argued that reformist influences on the new party should not be tolerated and a break with them was only a matter of time. As Engels wrote to Babel in 1879 after appointing Bernstein to the paper's editorial board, "You continue to regard these people as party comrades. We cannot do so. The points in question are points that can no longer be discussed in any proletarian party. To make them a subject of discussion within the party would be to put in question the whole of proletarian socialism." So I've talked for a long time, so I'm going to wind up really quickly. With just some general lessons about Marx. And I think one final kind of point to make about his kind of contribution to both the theory of revolution and its organisational form is his emphasis on the self-activity of the working class. And it's worth saying that the existing socialist movements of the time, like lots of them just were hostile to unions and associations, let alone strikes. An extremely popular theory of the time was like the iron law of the wages, the idea that strikes were like totally pointless because everything about capitalism will just reduce you to like the base level, subsistence level. Whereas Marx recognised that strikes weren't just a matter of like raising the real material conditions of the working class, but were also the essential like educator for working class struggle. And he constantly emphasised the need for these class battles to raise the working class position. I'll just end with a quote. He said, "In a state of society founded upon the antagonism of classes, if we want to prevent slavery in fact, as well as name, we must accept war." And that's Marx's real attitude to the class war.